Mark has been sharing his thoughts on how best to deal with the terrorist situation.
The press is salivating.
Mark has called a press conference for tomorrow morning, 7:30.
Now, why would you want to do a thing like that?
Why? Because that slug is a headliner. And God knows we can use the publicity.
Well, I was under the impression that that slug was a patient of ours, Mark, not some in-house celebrity.
Oh, no? Well, tell me, was the vermin that shot that judge last month, was he just a patient? Come on. I mean, Boston General made certain that everybody and his mother knew they were treating that little scum. I mean, you couldn't flip a channel without seeing Mousy Jimmy O'Toole.
Who's Jimmy O'Toole?
The hospital spokesman. Where has he been?
Why don't we hire an advertising agency and do a whole campaign?
You know, Donald, you can be a very negative thinking person. Do you know what people call this place? Not St. Eligius, St. Elsewhere. A dumping ground, a place you wouldn't want to send your mother-in-law.
Hi there, and welcome to Random Access Television. My name's Zach, and each episode of this podcast, my co-host Noss and I watch and review a completely random TV show that is picked for us by our vintage, warehouse-size, card-punch supercomputer. This week, we're brought to you by Smoking in Hospitals. You'd be shocked how recently it was still allowed. This time around, it's the mid-80s medical drama St. Elsewhere. So Noss, before yesterday, what was your experience with the show?
Well, Zach, this one, I was definitely aware of the show. I think I've seen a couple of episodes when I was way, way, way younger and probably way too young to actually be watching the show. So I didn't really remember it. I think my biggest reference to do with St. Elsewhere is that there was an album by Gnarls Barkley called St. Elsewhere in 2006, and I listened to that nonstop. But as far as the show itself goes, most of this was a total mystery.
So this is actually the first time this has been happening. I am currently watching this show for the first time, and I'm halfway through season five, currently five of six. So I had to avoid spoiling myself for the show, and also, we'll just get ahead of things here. We're not going to do a lot of spoilers. This is the first show we could have done that possibly has spoilers. Go figure, game shows and 90s random sitcoms don't really have plot lines that you need to spoil. But this one definitely does. Like, really does.
Major plot line spoilers.
I'm going to try not to spoil myself, you, or Noss. So there will be other than the first two episodes, which we're going to spoil the hell out of because that's what we do here. As few spoilers as possible.
As few as possible, though I'm sure a lot of people coming into this, if you're internet-minded at all, you have read the spoiler for the final episode, which I'm not going to talk about. But
I'm just not going to talk about because everybody's talked about it. It's a cliche.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's been done.
There's probably an entire podcast series just about that.
Just about the finale. Yes.
And not even the finale of the last 20 seconds. So
exactly. Exactly.
All right, so here's the basics. St. Elsewhere, it's a medical drama that ran on NBC from October 26, 1982 to May 25, 1988 for a total of 137 one-hour episodes. Each episode took place over the day in the life of a fictional St. Eligius Hospital, a failing, falling apart public hospital in South Boston. The show had an incredibly large cast, usually around 10 to 12 regulars over the years, but did have a solid core of 8 actors that are worth mentioning and were around for most or all of the show. Again, avoiding spoilers here. So they kind of fell into three different groups. The older fellows were first, the department heads, chiefs of medicine. They were played by Ed Flanders, Norman Lloyd, and William Daniels, who you might best know as Mr. Feeney.
Mr. Feeney!
He does not say the word Topanga once in the entire series. I have checked that out.
No.
And so the other group was the young residents, or interns as they were called at the time. The core group of that being the actors Ed Begley Jr., Howie Mandel, David Morse, and some guy named Denzel Washington?
Who's that?
I know, what a weird name. And then the third group was the non-doctors, including orderly Luther, who was played by Eric Lonville, and Nurse Rosenthal, played by Christina Pickles, who's just fun to say. The series was created by Grant Tinker and Bruce Paltrow for MTM Productions. That stands for Mary Tyler Moore, by the way. The two had previously created the critically acclaimed basketball drama White Shadow for CBS. And Grant Tinker had also basically been the production head of MTM. So the shows like Bob Newhart and Mary Tyler Moore and things like that. WKRP. So there were high hopes when the show was launched in 1982, because a year and a half before that, MTM had a similarly kind of tonal police series, Hill Street Blues. And even though it had started in the toilet, it was the number 27 series the season before St. Elsewhere was launched. Mm-hmm. But the show didn't do particularly well in the ratings. Never did. Mm. Never would. Mm. The highest it ever got was 47th out of roughly 100.
St. Elsewhere?
Yes.
No way! Oh my god! Wow, that's really surprising.
The audiences just never found it. I don't think it was ever even number one in its time slot.
Wow.
But luckily, by the time it got to air, Grant Tinker, who in addition to producing, writing, and directing the series, was also president of NBC.
Got it.
So it became kind of a vanity project. Okay. It didn't bring in the money, but it did bring in the awards and the talent that come along with it. It was nominated for 62 Emmys over the course of its six seasons. So for today's podcast, we watched two episodes, the first two, Nos, I know that you've got a lot to say, that you've been thinking about it
here. Definitely. I have a ton to say.
We try not to text ahead of the show, but for this one, I got a flurry. So go ahead.
So I came into this like we do our typical episodes, where I'm not too terribly interested in what the computer picks for us. I'm just like, hey, I'll go with whatever. So I set out to figure this was going to be a week like any other, and I was going to watch two unrelated episodes of an interesting drama from the 80s. That is not what happened. I watched the first episode of this, and I fell head over heels in love. I told my husband, okay, we're watching. That's it. We're watching this. So we actually, originally, Zach and I had a plan to watch and review and analyze an episode way later in the series. But I said, nope, we're going to do the first two because I want to watch this in a linear way. Yeah. I was just totally hooked. And yeah, from the first, honestly, three scenes, I was like, okay, yeah, this is a good show. This is solid.
Yeah, I rewatching it as a person who is currently watching it later on, and I'm not a binge watcher generally, so I've been watching this basically for the last, I don't know, year and a half. It takes me a while to watch these sort of things. It was kind of weird to go back in time and see like, oh, this character is doing blank and this character is still on the show. I forgot about him or her completely, you know.
Yeah, it really reminds me. I mean, it's something that I'm going to be referring to probably throughout our podcast here. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Dr. Scott Olson wrote about, and he was a former communications professor, and he coined a phrase called meta television, which I think we can go ahead and call it what we're used to calling as like prestige or legacy television, a show that's very sophisticated, often like self-referential.
Yeah.
This to me very much is in the flavor of many HBO shows that we watch nowadays.
Yeah.
It's you mentioned West Wing earlier. It's very Sorkin-esque in a lot of ways. I would say Sorkin's good work rather than his bad work, though we differ on what we think the good work and the bad work
is. Can we both agree that Studio 60 was bad?
I would probably say that when I was the least attached.
Okay, there we go.
But yeah, this is definitely, you can see the seeds of that prestige, just excellent drama, just heavy hitting drama.
So for the pilot, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. It's very, the camera will, and this is one of the earliest shows I've seen that's ever done this, the camera will kind of follow two groups of people who are doing a walk and talk conversation, and then it'll just pause and then follow other people. So you hear the end of one conversation and overlapping conversations. Now, they did do this a lot more in the pilot than they do in most normal episodes going forward, but they still continue to do it. It's not quite as heavy as it is the first time. And also, as a fan of medical dramas, this is kind of my favorite genre, as you listeners well know, is sitcoms with laugh tracks, multi-camera sitcoms. Medical shows are probably my second favorite subgenre of shows. I have watched the entirety of ER multiple times, and I never rewatch shows, like almost ever. It's kind of funny how very similar the pilot to this is to the pilot of ER. Which have you ever watched much ER?
No, just as your favorites are sitcoms and medical shows, those are my two least favorites.
Well, there we go. That's why we have this podcast together.
Exactly.
Yeah, the pilot of ER follows Dr. Green, who is Anthony Edwards' character. He's a resident. He's kind of the caring one. You know, it's very similar to how this episode follows David Morse's Dr. Morrison as kind of the primary character. As I believe in both shows, it actually even starts with him getting woken up by a nurse. It's very similar and very influenced, and I think every medical show ever has been influenced by this show, you know, completely.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the only other medical show that I've really, really, really attached to was House MD, which, I mean, I can see some of the seats, the snappy back and forth, for sure.
House was a little bit different, though, because it's the most procedural of any medical show I've ever seen.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah, it's barely a medical show, to be honest. I mean,
it was more of a soap opera.
Well, it was kind of a procedural. It was like a medical
like
mystery
a procedural
show.
Soap opera. Yeah.
Like a mystery, because it was always what's the weird disease of the week. With most medical shows, it's just like, all right, you have cancer. We know that. We don't need to figure that out. There's no mystery solving sort of thing. It was kind of like CSI, but with a medical twist. So
good point. Yeah.
So what characters, what situations, what struck your fancy there?
Oh my gosh. Okay, well, let's see. I wanted to go over a couple of things, because the first episode definitely was that typical pilot episode in the way that it was very balls to the wall, bombastic. Mm-hmm. Like, they definitely threw everything they had to try to get this thing going. Right away, I don't know what his name is yet, because I'm only two episodes in, but the very tall blonde fellow with glasses.
Dr. Ehrlich, yes.
Dr. Ehrlich, I love him.
Yes.
I love him.
He is definitely a fan favorite on that show. He has done that character on other shows, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It kind of made his career. The suck up resident with the weird. Yeah, he's definitely a good one.
I definitely totally have a thing for usually the characters that are like the tall, gangly weirdos that dress weird and are like super suck up to their superiors. I think if anybody out there who knows what I like is listening to this, they're like, yeah, Nos, we know. But yeah, he stood out to me right away. But of course, with that said, I don't know too much about that character yet, because he's not in it too terribly much.
No, he's not. He's kind of a... Well, yeah, he's a background character, because they have such a large ensemble, different characters get different focus each episode, and later on, you know, characters will disappear for an episode or two.
Well, I think the difference that I noticed between the first one and the second one is there was, in the first episode, there was an orderly who, he was kind of a short guy, and he was, and I don't remember his name straight off, but he wasn't really in the second episode that much.
Luther the orderly. Yeah. He's definitely, I think he's actually maybe my favorite character,
second favorite character.
A lot. Yeah, he's there for a good chunk of the run there, and he's kind of a fan favorite character as well.
He's great. Yeah. I mean, right away, you can see the really standout cast. I mean, Denzel Washington isn't in it very much in these first two episodes, but right away, he's on screen and it's electric. It's like, wow, that guy knows what he's doing.
All right. So I got to ask a couple of characters, actors here. So what did you think of Mr. Feeney, Mr. Mark Craig, Well, I'll let you explain maybe his personality there.
Okay, well, I'm definitely going to call him Mr. Feeney, because that's just, I grew up in the 90s and that's how it goes. Mm-hmm. And I watched Boy Meets World, all of them. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Feeney is really interesting, because the first time you see him, he is basically on a really racist diatribe.
Yes.
Like, my first introduction to this guy is that he's racist.
Yeah.
And
there is there's an Indian character on the show. Dr. Vijay Kochhar, played by Kavi Raz, who I believe might have been the first South Asian regular on television, but don't 100% quote me on that, but I can't think of any other examples. So
right away, Mr. Feeney is like lighting, you know, the guy, the Indian fellow isn't in the room, but Mr. Feeney is like, you know, this, I'm not going to go into what he says, but he is going on like this racist tirade. And so I was a little like, oh, okay, interesting. But what I thought how they handled very interestingly is that I'm not quite sure yet if they're tackling it as a commentary on what was going on in hospitals at the time, or just as a fact of life of a modern 1980s work setting. But I didn't get the feeling they were exactly supporting what he was saying.
No, but, it's, you know.
Go ahead.
Sort of. I mean, as the time goes on, This is not a spoiler in any way. He does not get any less racist.
Interesting.
As the series goes on, he gets maybe a little quieter about it. And in that sort of way that you kind of humanize, you know, Archie Bunker or something through the time. But mm-hmm. his basic personality does not change. Not one
bit. Okay, that's really interesting because I thought, despite that I, of course, don't necessarily agree with it, and I don't necessarily even want to call it dated either because I think it's actually a very realistic element to many mm-hmm. workplaces when you have a group of mostly white men, professional white men, and you'll have one occasionally that pops off and says something really mean and racist and everybody just kind of rolls their eyes and shuffles their feet and doesn't say anything.
Yeah, especially in an environment as cloistered as is, not necessarily cloistered, an environment as hierarchical as medical
definitely.
Is.
Definitely.
Especially
yeah.
was back then. A lot of the focus of the pilot especially is about the long hours mm-hmm. that medical residents work. And back then, it was just insane. They would have you work like 3 straight days.
Right. And you can tell because they have this awesome little like digital clock mm-hmm. in the corner of a lot of the scenes where you can see like the time just like ticking by. You'll be in there for 12 hours. And yeah, there's an aspect of the sort of the slice of life mm-hmm. that I thought was handled particularly well in these two episodes. And it's a rare thing to see time be portrayed so well in a drama show.
Yeah, agreed. And especially the slice of life thing, because this is there's a lot of doctor shows out there, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of emergency room shows or shows about mm-hmm. surgeons, but this is a show about the whole hospital. So right. it's not just, I mean, like, for instance, our main character in the first couple of episodes, Dr. David Morse, that's the actor, not the character, he's not in the ER. He's not a surgeon. He's an internist. He is there at the ICU making sure that patients are staying alive. He's not one of the cool professions like on Grey's Mm-mm. Anatomy or ER or something.
Mm-mm. No, nobody here is that. And maybe that's what drew me to it, is with the exception of Howie Mandel, who is supposed to be kind of like the hip young mm-hmm. doctor, sort of. He's kind of young and hip, but I wouldn't really call anyone here hip.
Yeah, and they definitely hit you with what they can get away with in 1983 when they couldn't before.
Oh, yeah.
When one of the main characters, as a matter of fact, the second billed doctor, mm-hmm. has VD and spends the entire episode going around telling all the nurses that he's presumably had relations with
right,
you might want to get yourself right. checked.
Yeah, and that was really, I mean, though I would say that's like maybe fairly typical of a lot of 80s shows. I definitely the VD plot line is not something we get in modern TV.
Well, no, as later on the show in the world of AIDS has to address it in a completely different way.
So yeah, I mean, that was really interesting. I loved the little side story that went on with Howie Mandel and the goth chick. Uh-oh. And they ended up like doing it in the morgue.
Yeah,
I loved it. I was howling. I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, and they did it twice in the second
twice.
Episode as well. Yeah, when I started watching the show, Howie Mandel's sex scene was not something I was expecting to ever see, let alone twice in less than 2 hours. So
no, that's very true. And I mean, hey, he's not my type of guy, but it was funny. I laughed, and they're definitely pushing him as like, you know, like I said, like the hip, cute, young he's doctor dude.
He's the dad from Bobby's World. All right, so because you were talking about how much this is similar to a lot of other shows, but the thing mm-hmm. is, it wasn't at the time, like
right.
at all. So just right. kind of a little tangent here. So explains kind of the appeal of the show quite a bit, this little tangent I'm going to go on. So before Hill Street Blues and this show, TV dramas, with minor exceptions I'll get to later, they were completely different than they do now. So for example, Lou Grant, which was a show by the same producers, it was a premiere show, won a bunch of awards, came out roughly the same time. It was a show about newspaper reporters. But unlike St. Elsewhere or anything you watch now, if you watch Grey's Anatomy or This Is Us or any drama now, mm-hmm. even most cop shows, the stories didn't continue from week to week. Mm-hmm. Every episode mm-hmm. was a beginning, middle, and end. And the main characters, they never changed. If you were mm-hmm. one of the reporters on Lou Grant, you may reveal, I don't know, that you have like a fear of flying or something. But that's just a plot for that specific episode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Monster of the Week.
Yeah. You know, there was no mythology, if you're going to go the X-Files route. There was no serialization whatsoever. Maybe a reoccurring character might have something, but characters didn't divorce. They didn't change their opinions. They were exactly the same. I mean, they never died. It was very rare. They were exactly the same at the beginning of the next episode as they were at the end. You know, the lessons were forgotten and everything. But things started to change. And Seen Elsewhere was the first doctor show to do this, or at least the first successful one that I've been able to find. And Hill Street Blues was the first police one. But there was kind of an evolution of things. So there were exceptions. So soap operas, daily soap operas. In primetime, though, serialized shows where plots continued from episode to episode were incredibly rare until the early 80s. So there was the occasional primetime show. There was Peyton Place on ABC, but they actually ran that three times a week. So it was almost like a daytime soap in the in primetime. But other ones never gained traction, and neither did serialization. But that began to change in the 70s with two things. So first of all, there were family shows. Shows like The Waltons, Family, and Little House on the Prairie being the biggest ones. They actually did have serialization from episode to episode to a degree. So, you know, the plots would still be resolved at the end of every episode. But the characters were allowed to change, mostly because they were forced to, because the kids were getting older.
We're getting old. Right. Okay.
You couldn't have Elizabeth Walton doing the same little girl shtick when she's seven that you did when she was 17 by the time the show ended.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting.
And then miniseries. So miniseries hit in the late 70s, and they were huge. Some of them, like Roots, when the third episode of Roots, I believe, the slavery drama, came out, it was the most watched TV show ever.
That's really interesting. That's exactly when the there was a lot of I think historical dramas that were happening. They were similar with some Holocaust media that came out at that point in time and started the whole memory boom of facing trauma and things like that.
Yeah, Roots kind of did a whole thing about finding your roots, facing trauma. Just whose trauma is it this week? But not only they explored in popularity, but some of them were so popular but had stories that you could turn into series. So something like Rich Man, Poor Man, which was a very popular miniseries at the time, became a series on ABC. Eventually, one of these shows became a massive hit. Dallas.
Ah, good old Dallas.
Dallas started as a miniseries but was so popular they brought it back. And it was actually the number one TV show of 1980, the year that these other shows started to premiere. That was the year that Hill Street Blues premiered and then allowed for Seen Elsewhere. And that's kind of where the general idea of dramas as we know them with the serialization came from. Because before that, my wife was very frustrated over the summer. She fell in love with this old Western called The Virginian.
I was just talking about it with her earlier.
Yeah.
That's funny.
And she loved the characters, and I did too, but every episode was exactly the same. The characters never changed. They would have an argument, like, fiercely, and then the next episode, not mentioned. And so eventually, because everything was guest star-based, you know, you'd have Leslie Nielsen come to town as a con man or something, and then Leslie Nielsen's plot would get a beginning, middle, and end, because he would never appear on the show again either, and that was it. It was kind of like a series of movies, except your main cast is half the same every single, you know, time.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I was aware of, I think, again, sort of the meta-television, like, prestige narrative type thing. I mean, I'm, of course, familiar with it. I would say the late 90s stuff, Oz, and, of course, The Sopranos, for me, was the big introduction. However, there were a few that were kind of bridged the gap, like NYPD Blue, which, at times, from what I've seen already, Saint Elsewhere does remind me of NYPD Blue. Which was a fantastic show. I know that dates me definitely a little bit, and I have no idea if it's even available on streaming.
It is on Hulu as well. Yes.
Cool. Yeah, and I definitely, the linear drama is a strange concept. I mean, essentially, it's a movie, but it's not a movie.
Right.
It's a show, but it's a little bit more than a show because you start to get attached. You start to want to know the characters. And this was the kind of thing that, I mean, I love that type of character-driven drama, which is what immediately hooked me into Saint Elsewhere. I was like, okay, well, I want to know where these people went to school. I want to know who their spouses are, who has things together. Like, I wanted to know everything about everyone.
Yeah, so you get a little bit more of that in the second episode. The second episode, it has... So the main plot from the first two that overlaps is there was a terrorist bombing, and a patient comes into the ER in the pilot, and in the second episode, she's in there along with the terrorist himself, played by a very, very young Tim Robbins in his first ever role.
Victor knew who he was right away, and I was like, I don't know who this is.
You don't know Tim Robbins? You never seen Shawshank Redemption or anything?
I have actually never seen Shawshank Redemption. Wow. Yeah, I know. This is me. This is me. I've seen all the weirdo stuff, but I've never seen Shawshank Redemption.
I didn't see it until, you know, 10 years after its release either, but at least I've seen it. Are you a communist?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's true. And then the second episode, so it does focus a little bit on Morrison. So he's taking care of Tim Robbins' terrorist character, who's this a rich boy little snot. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of one of the main plot lines. The other plot line is the first humor episode. And this show had a lot of humor in it.
It definitely did. Yeah.
Throughout the years, this was the psychologist character played by...
Oh, Beale, it was the psychologist, and then with Lorraine Newman.
She showed up, I'm like, oh yeah, this is, Noss is going to love this show.
Noss is going to love this,
got Lorraine Newman on it.
I love her. I have always loved her. I think she's gorgeous. I think she's amazing. I was like, Lorraine Newman.
Geez, that's not her last appearance, I'll just tell you that much.
I didn't think so. Yeah, she's too good. She's too good.
I mean, this show started the career of a lot of people. So for instance, I had all the list here. So for instance, you know, eventually the cast changes as they do on a lot of shows these days, as well. You know, characters die, characters leave, actors get fired or quit with no explanation. Some notable actors that eventually become onto the show, Helen Hunt, very young Helen Hunt, Stephen Furst. You might best known as Flounder from Animal House. Ronnie Cox, France Nguyen, Bruce Greenwood, and Mark Harmon. They all come in later seasons. So a lot of them got their kind of first start doing the show, or at least their big break, especially in the case of Mark Harmon, you know, People's Sexiest Man of the Year, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, for an early 80s show, it's got a very diverse cast, which I always appreciate. They didn't have to do it, but they did.
Yeah, there's two Asians in the cast, which is amazing, which I don't think there was another show with two Asians in the cast until All American Girl in 1993.
Again
until Fresh Off the Boat in 2010.
Right. And yeah, there was absolutely, and I don't know, you know, it had a cast that was, that there are definitely scenes where, for instance, they're in the cafeteria and there's a whole table of doctors who, you know, are people of color. And
that's kind of played for laughs, though, unfortunately.
I think it was. However, there is an element of reality to it, especially at the time, you know. And I mean, I'm not necessarily saying I agree with the portrayal or I like the portrayal. But again, there was that element of this predominantly white male workspace where, you know, all the doctors of color have to go and sit at this table. And I thought that was, although it was played for laughs, I thought it was an interesting addition all the same.
Right. So I will say, before we get to the end here, not a spoiler, but the show does have one major problem, I will say. Let's just put it this way. If you looked at all the actors I've mentioned, almost all of them are male. There are female characters on the show, but they might as well not be. It's not a show that's good for its... women cast members.
Definitely agree.
To say the least, it does not pass the Bechdel test ever. No. Pretty much
there's
one scene later on where you know, I was watching one later on where Alfre Woodard, who's also a cast member later on, and France Nguyen are having a moment together about just how hard it is to be a doctor, and I was like, oh, this might be the first scene that's ever passed the Bechdel test, a scene where there's two women talking or more, and they're not talking about a male character. That's the Bechdel test. That might have been like one of three in the entire first five seasons of this show. It is a premier drama, but it is quite sexist in its own way.
I definitely agree with that. As you know, again, examining it with the lens of many shows at the time, there were shows who had female characters who were portraying women's stories a lot better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you even look at a contemporary, something like Cagney and Lacey, for instance, that Cheers. Was around the same time. Cheers. Yeah. Even so. From what I've seen of Hill Street Blues, the female characters on there were generally a little bit better.
Definitely.
I remember one time I was watching an episode and my wife was in the next room and I was like, oh, look, the female characters are getting the spotlight. This one had a miscarriage. This one's getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. And this one's sleeping around, all in the mm-hmm. same episode.
However, I will say this that I found poignant, and this might be my age showing. Mm-hmm. I apologize, Gen Z listeners out there. I thought, unfortunately, I don't know the doctor's name, but there was a woman who was getting very overattached to finding one of her patients who the patient later ended up turning up dead, basically. It was a minor plot line. It wasn't like a big thing. And she went to go talk to the head doctor, and she was freaking out and she was really emotional. And she's just like, you know, this is my job and to keep track of these people. And basically the head doctor said something like, you know, you just need to let go.
Yeah.
You can't take care of everyone. And believe it or not, I really liked that.
Yeah. No, that was a good moment.
I really thought it was poignant. I thought it was really poignant. And the fact that it was a woman is notable. Because
I believe they even specifically mentioned that in the scene. Even a woman has to give up sometime or something like that.
Right, which is funny because literally an adjacent plot line was how attached to the male doctor was getting to a patient, mm-hmm. and he was not condemned for it.
Right.
Not as much as the woman was. No. However, with that said, I thought it was a good scene. I thought it was well done, and I thought it was poignant.
Yeah, the Dr. Westfall gives the advice at the end of the episode.
That's
a bit of an ongoing thing, at least for the first season or so.
Yeah, I figured he'd probably... It seemed like something that would... Definitely, they would, with him walking out of the hospital, the shot of him walking out, I'm like, yeah, they're going to keep using this, aren't they?
Yeah. Just one last note before we get to my final thing here and our reviews, although you can probably guess what our reviews are going to be at this point. I liked there was a line in the Verity pilot. There's the older gentleman who runs the store, not the store, runs the hospital, Dr. Auschlander, Norman Lloyd. He has terminal cancer, they say at the beginning, and he's walking up the stairs. And one of the lines is, he's going to outlive us all. Well, guess what? He has. He is still alive, the actor.
Oh, my God.
He is 107 and still working. And he is actually the oldest working actor in Hollywood currently.
Wow. Well, that's a high note to end on.
It is. Yeah, he's still going. His last movie was in 2019.
Oh, my God. Well, good for him. He beat COVID and Trump and like everything. He just keeps on trucking.
Exactly. So... this show definitely had an impact on every TV drama afterwards, and I hate to read lists, but there's a list that I'm going to read here, and you'll find out why. It definitely had impact on every medical show after that, including ER. It's probably why it's been homaged so many times. I actually watched an episode of Scrubs earlier today where four of the leads were in there giving advice to everything. And one of the reasons the Tommy Westfall theory works, I'm not going to talk about it too much, but basically it's that all TV is a shared universe, is that this show was homaged so many times, but also it was a very meta show. It has a lot of TV references in it. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, sometimes, especially for us, like people like me who like obscure ones, they reference, you know, I was watching an episode the other day and they referenced the TV shows Manimal and Misfits of Science in the same breath. There's an episode.
Song lyrics abound, which I love.
Dr. Crow. Well, you pick up the song lyrics and I pick up the one season failed sitcom. So there you go. At one point, Dr. Craig says, I haven't had this much fun since I was with BJ Honeycutt, who was from MASH, you know. The tall African-American orderly who's in the second episode, he is actually a character from The White Shadow playing the exact same character. And at one point, they also go off into Cheers. Alfre Woodard's character and Ed Begley Jr.'s character show up on Homicide later as their characters. Their plot, Homicide Life on the Street. So
that's very cool.
Though a lot of them didn't have credits beforehand, some of the writers and producers of the show went on to create an amazing assortment of TV shows. So normally I avoid reading long lists, but this one I have to. So this is the impact that this show had because it was the premiere show. So the writer, the writer of the pilot, Joshua Brand, went on to create Northern Exposure and The Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
His co-writer, John Massuis, created Providence and Touched by an Angel.
Oh, wow.
Mark Tinker went on to produce L.A. Law, NYPD Blue, Private Practice, and Chicago PD. John Tinker, I wonder if there's any relation there, produced Chicago Hope, Judging Amy, and The Practice.
Okay,
Eric
cool.
Overmyer produced these shows but didn't create Law & Order, The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, and Bosch.
Yeah. Yep.
And finally, Tom Fontana created Homicide, Life on the Street, and Oz.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Yeah. It's all star. I mean, yeah, that's amazing. And it all comes through. It all comes through. You can really see the seeds of plot lines from many of those shows, many which I love, many which I've seen. You can see a lot of just the seeds, the foundation of it being arranged in St. Elsewhere. That's awesome. That's very cool.
So it's time for our final reviews. I suspect I know where you are going, but...
I mean, yeah, what can I say? I mean, I don't know if I'm necessarily going to say A+ yet, because it's just the first two episodes, but A, solid A for both.
Same, yep.
And, I have no... I mean, my criticisms are historical for the most part, and having to do with a lot of media tropes at the time, i.e. the racial stuff and the sexist stuff. As far as the actual, the meat of the show, the plot line, the story, the acting, it's great. A.
Yep. Sip. Same here. Can't go wrong with this show. It's on Hulu right now. I cannot recommend it enough, especially if you like any sort of medical drama. If you like Grey's Anatomy, you like ER, you like The Resident.
It's just like good TV.
Well, yeah, exactly. But this is, just watch it.
Good TV. Just watch it.
Just watch it. Sign up for Hulu. It's worth it.
It's worth it.
You can get ESPN Plus for free, too, if you want to watch European soccer at 3 a.m.
Or marble racing.
All right, so it is time to fire up this supercomputer we got here. Let me get these cards punched in the right order. Whew. Okay, so we are going to daytime. You have definitely heard of this one, sort of. The David Letterman Show.
Okay.
Not
daytime.
It's not his nighttime show. Okay. It's not the CBS one that you're familiar with, or the NBC one before that. It's his unsuccessful daytime show from 1980. A single episode is available on YouTube. And it is in our playlist that we will have links to at our social media, as well as in the description of that episode and probably about half of our episodes. Any of the things on YouTube, you can see any of the shows we've watched that are on YouTube in there, and any future ones, because we record these well in advance, you can also see as well. So any thoughts about David Letterman before we go out?
I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic that it won't suck as bad as some of his later shows did, but we'll see.
Yeah, same. All right, so it's time for us to go. See you next time.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Random Access Television. And if you haven't already, please remember to subscribe to us on Apple and Spotify podcasts. We also love to read reviews, so go ahead and leave us one. You can find us at RATVPod, that's RATVPOD, at twitter.com. And if you have questions, complaints, compliments, recipes, email us at RATVPod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Bye-bye.
Can you say hi to Auntie Nas?
Hi, Auntie Nas.
Hi.
He can't hear you.
He can't hear me.
So you can say all the horrible things you want.
No.
All right. Okay. So, Hiram, do you think I should do this in my Scrooge McDuck voice? Mm-hmm. Do you think I should talk like this the entire time?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
All right. I'll do the whole podcast like this. All right. So, hi there, and welcome to Random Access Television. My name's Zuck, and each episode of this podcast... No. Okay.